get the problem solved. In the meantime, there's Alaska's royalty for all of it. As a 20-year Alaskan myself, having worked in resource development the total 20 years that I've been here, I understand the significance and the importance of Alaska wanting to keep the royalty here. And we're in a posture, our companies are in a posture, have been in a posture to discuss with the state anytime, with Fairbanks anytime, with Anchorage anytime, or anyone else anytime, how our system can be responsive to those needs. It's a little difficult, however, to have any meaningful discussions if when you start the discussions, people say, well, we're totally opposed to your project in the first place. So we are in a position to talk. We would like to talk. We have no problem in terms of the commissioner has suggested of having a call on state royalty. That's no problem. And if anyone here in this room, and I've asked, and I hope that the answer could be responsive, if you can tell us today that there's a market in Fairbanks for 218 million cubic feet a day of gas, we'll start working with you right away to determine an economic method, because it is economical, to get it here. So far, there hasn't been anything like that. I understand those problems. We're willing to wait and look for additional call on royalty. That's no problem. We'd be acceptable to that and moderate that at any time and talk about it any time. Now, in terms of the taxes, because of the filing hasn't been complete on El Paso's part as well as ours, we can estimate what our taxes are going to be as far as the state of Alaska is concerned. You can also understand the problems because of the fact that the net take back to Alaska relates to what the wellhead price is going to be. Now, anybody can speculate as to what the wellhead price might be. The wellhead price is 35 cents. That the returns for that in terms of taxes and royalties directly back to the state treasury might be about $50 million a year. If someone decided that the parity, natural gas parity in terms of BTU for crude oil and relating, and again, the wellhead price hasn't been that established on crude oil, but say they were in an area where parity would be 98 cents, wellhead price for a million BTUs, then you're talking about close to $150 million a year that would go directly back to the state of Alaska in terms of revenue. We anticipate that we'll probably pay about $1.5 million a year to the state in income tax. And probably, as far as real estate taxes are concerned, that's difficult, too, because of the fact that so far in existing laws, liquefaction plants have been exempt from taxation. Also because of the fact that the liquefaction plant that's been discussed is in an area where there is no political subdivision of government, so you wonder about the jurisdiction on that taxation. But it looks like, from what we've been able to determine, that probably the ad valorem real estate taxes in Alaska will probably rate to about $10 million on our project and about $20 million on El Paso. You're talking about $9, $10 million difference in ad valorem tax. But again, it's hard to pin that down. But what is important is that the gas is being, and the movements are, all the signs are for deregulation of gas, particularly new gas. The legislature heard Milton Lipton say that if that's the case, if gas is going to be priced on commodity value, and it should, it hasn't been priced properly before, the transportation cost is going to figure dramatically in terms of what the netback is going to be to the state in terms of the wellhead price. Because then they're going to talk about the cost of the product in the market, taking transportation costs out of it, the balance left, if it's going to be priced in the market, to go back to the wellhead to yield more returns to Alaska. In terms of physical plant and jobs, when you're looking at the long-range future of Alaska, we feel that our project, because of more net back to the state treasury, directly back, without having to have requirements on that money that's going to go in there to pay for additional social infrastructure, or community infrastructure, to develop new country, makes more money available to the Treasury of Alaska to spend that money in other resource areas of non-renewable resources. The state has an option then of where do we want the jobs? Where do we want the emphasis put? Where do we want to beef up our programs in other areas to provide jobs here or in other resource areas? They don't have to be trapped to saying we don't have any choice because we've got the minimal impacts of this project. We're going to have to build a new community here. We're going to have to build more schools here. We're going to have to put more troopers on, more hospitals. What we've been in so far in advance of the Alaska pipeline, using, if you will, $900 million that didn't have a price, it didn't have one earmark on it. Ladies and gentlemen, I appreciate the time that you've given me here. And just a final wrap-up, resources here, the country needs it down there. We want the spin-offs here. The major spin-offs are going to come with the use of royalty gas in Alaska. It's not practical, perhaps, at this point in time to say that all the resource development, all the petrochemical plants are going to be here. That's probably just out of the question. Keep the call on it. We're talking about 26 trillion cubic feet in Prudhoe Bay versus the state's Geological Survey Division and Natural Resources saying that there's potential in speculative reserves of 423 trillion cubic feet of gas in Alaska, and a lot of it in areas that are a lot more accessible. There's no way Alaska is going to be denied a petrochemical industry. There's no way it's going to be denied large liquefaction plants on the south coast of Alaska, because that has to happen to get the gas in those areas to the market. In the one place in Alaska, north of the Brooks Range, where gas can come from that area and take advantage of the cheaper, safest, dependable, efficient system for moving that gas to the market, why then, in the interest of long-range planning, say that that can't happen, take the only option available away from that area just for the fact of having additional liquefaction plants on the south coast when you know we're going to have them anyway.
Thanks very much, Bob. Well, you've heard both sides of the problem, and I think you'll both agree we're fortunate to have the problem. We're going to reverse the order, and I suspect we'll move through this rather rapidly, and then we'll get into the questions from the press. Chuck, do you have a few comments that you'd care to make and wrap up here?
No, Frank. I think I'd rather wait for some questions.
All right. We've had one pass for questions. Senator Stevens?
Briefly. I'd like to ask Bob. He said he'd respond to questions. How many of you realize that natural gas is coming down the oil pipeline to the fourth pumping station, over halfway to Fairbanks? I'd like to ask why, if it's the company, the Arctic company, is ready to negotiate. We haven't had a proposal and some cost analysis of what it would cost to continue to supply the other pump stations and then get that gas to this area. In any event. Secondly, at one time I suggested, and people do accuse me of being a little bit of a dreamer at times, but we had the Haynes pipeline that was shut down. I asked the Corps of Engineers to look at it. Would it be possible to take the Haynes pipeline now, run the Haynes pipeline, what the usable pipe that's left from the Cook Inlet area to here now? It could be done by next year and bring gas up to this area now with the idea that when that other pipeline comes through, that could be reversed. Why haven't some of these things that would benefit Alaska now and benefit this area with a natural gas supply now, why hasn't that been explored? Thirdly, I'd like to know, has it been explored, the concept of exchanging? The gas that Chuck Herbert mentioned in the Cook Inlet is available. It is now being expanded. With the lower Cook Inlet, be even greater expanded. We could actually take our royalty gas, if you'll follow this, the royalty gas that's owed to us from the North Slope production at Cook Inlet, and ship it all the way up and down this rail belt with a third or less of the pipe involved and have a completely gasified urban area, but the Fairbanks Anchorage area be completely gasified and have the pipe, if the pipelines go through Canada, ship 8/8 out that way and take our 1/8 down below if an exchange could be worked out. I've never heard anyone other than just suggested it's possible. And so, Bob, I ask you, has it been explored and what's the status? With regard to John Bennett, John, I'd tell you, if I had $1,000, I'd take your bet. And I'd take it for this reason, that those of us in public office must push you and anyone else that makes a proposal to utilize this gas to complete that by 1979. Because let me tell you, we own 1/8 of the gas. It will be produced with the oil. It's soluble gas, the gas cap plus the soluble gas. It will be produced. And in order to keep the 2 million barrels of oil per day running, it will be reinjected at our cost. We will pay the bill if that pipeline structure is not ready by 1979. And believe me, we cannot afford that bill in terms of the loss of the energy to put it back in, bring it out later, and the total loss of the capital involved. So I say to you, that's a comment, not a question. I have some figures that I'd like to cite there. I mentioned the problem at the very beginning of an really infuriating our Canadian neighbors, and I think that's what El Paso's doing. During the embargo, it was Canada that stepped in and supplied the United States over half of what we lost during the embargo. I wonder how many of you realize that Canada is now moving LNG from Montreal in refrigerated trucks to Massachusetts and Rhode Island at the rate of 667 million cubic feet a day. One of the most impossible situations in the world, but they are moving it to meet the problem caused by the retaliation of the Arabs to our foreign policy. The interprovincial gas pipeline, which is Canada's largest line, starts in Edmonton. It moves through the United States. I don't know if you know this. It's a 48-inch oil pipeline. It goes through the United States through about 8 of our states and then goes back up to Montreal and it will be extended into Ottawa. During this whole period, and during the period since we've had the Alaska Highway, I cannot remember our Canadian neighbors interfering with our commerce. And the proposal that I think will infuriate our Canadian neighbors, because as I said, whether the Alaska pipeline is built first or the Arctic pipeline is built first, there will be two or more pipelines, and one of them must go through Canada before we're through. If we're dealing with the amount of gas that Chuck and his people estimate, I would say to El Paso, what good is it to to rely on our basic prejudices, and I'm as prejudiced as anyone in this room about America First and have offered a lot of legislation in that regard. What good is it, in the final analysis, to destroy the relationships we have with Canada, to talk about the concepts of Canada being unfriendly and the loss of tax dollars to the United States in terms of that chart, when we are already exporting to Canada almost $10 billion a year to get the energy that East Coast and Midwest needs now, and they're very vitally deficient. So, John, I would say to you, what do you gain? What do you gain by irritating our Canadian neighbors in order to prove what we want anyway? We all want, I assume, that as much investment in Alaska and as much gas of our gas left in Alaska. But the concepts of saying that this is an unreliable system, today, without that 667 million cubic feet, the industrial East would be dead. We've had curtailments of gas from Texas, from Louisiana. The production of gas is falling off. And if it were not for the imports of oil and gas from Canada today, the industrial nation that we are, well, we would not be there. That's why the 22 people in the Senate are already for the Canadian line. They come from states that have faced these curtailments. And I try to make you think about the realism of dealing as one state out of 50 dealing with a national problem. And he's my very good friend, or I wouldn't address him as quickly as I do. And my question to you is, John, what do you gain by that argument?
That's not the argument I'm making, Senator Stevens. I am not unfriendly to Canada. I don't think that Canada is an unreliable country. I think we owe it to the American people to point out that we're paying three times as much for that energy as we were a year ago this week. I think we owe it to the American people to quote the Prime Minister of British Columbia, who's going to make that four times for the state of Washington early next year. I'm merely quoting facts. I don't think it's unfriendly to take economic advantage of a situation. I don't think that the Arabs are reliable. I also will say that the country would be up the creek without Arab imports. We would be up the creek without Canadian imports, but I think we ought to know that we're trebling the prices of it. And therefore, unless it is necessary, we should not widen that opportunity. I don't think that's unfriendly to Canada. I think that's a way to lose friends, to give them that kind of opportunity, and they've proven that they'll take it. I'd like to mention the wastage of energy in this system of ours. In the filing that most people in this room have seen, our total use of gas in this system is 12.1%. This has been filed with the Federal Power Commission. The last time I heard Bob mention the use of his gas, it was 9.6%. That is a long way from twice the amount of gas being used. Also, as I've said publicly, the cryogenics, the cold of this gas, some of it can be recovered. It's being used to freeze food in southern France now. It's being used to produce industrial gases. It's being used in Tokyo, Alaskan gas in Tokyo, LNG, to combat thermal pollution. The extent that we can reduce 12.1%, I cannot say now because we've got 3 years of development to do. But if we don't reduce it a bit, it's about 2% more than 9.6, and that's a lot different from twice as much. And I feel a little upset about that because we've had that on the street for over a month, and it's broken down to every pump station. When we talk about getting gas to the United States, I'd like to read a little statement by the Canadian president, Bob's counterpart in Canada. This is a statement he made about a month ago. It has been suggested by some that the Arctic gas pipeline would be primarily a conduit for export of additional gas to the U.S. markets. Nothing could be further from the fact. Vern Hordes. Such suggestions simply fail to recognize that all of the Delta gas, which is required by Canadian consumers, will be available to Canadians as soon as the pipeline can be built. That's what the National Energy Board export controls provide. I don't consider that unfriendly to Americans. I think it's a statement of fact. On displacement, I merely want to tell you that according to the figures of the Federal Power Commission, and these pipeline systems now in the ground in the United States, in 1980, there will be 10 billion cubic feet a day of excess capacity. The maximum gas that can ever be delivered to the coast of the United States of the proven reserves under this project is 3 billion. I say to you right now that we are exchanging and have for 20 years, Bob, with a member of Arctic Gas here, 500 million cubic feet a day by displacement. I quote John Partridge, chairman of the Columbia Gas Company that has purchased tentatively Prudhoe Bay Gas. He said, if the all-Canadian or the all-American line goes in, we are confident we will have our gas delivered. John Partridge, member of Arctic Gas. So it's hard for me to believe that using these existing pipelines is infeasible. I've heard no one in the transmission business think that it's anything except what we've been doing for 20 years in this. So the capacity is there. It doesn't make sense to me to start a new 3,700-mile pipeline when our present pipeline system is 10 billion cubic feet under capacity. It's not El Paso's fault. It's just a fact of the times that that's the way the gas should be transmitted, and it'll be cheaper. I recognize that you can call unconventional the LNG process, but it is interesting that we will deliver more gas per day to the lower 48 than is proposed by Arctic Gas, and we'll do it for a little less than $6 billion as opposed to over $10 billion. If that's the kind of unconventional system that are coming in, I'd say hurrah for the unconventional system. I have nothing more to add. Thank you.
Bob. Thank you, Frank. I should point out, you know, John, I really have to congratulate you. You sure do a lot for me, you know. You really keep me on my toes. The exchange is the 6,000 miles and the 2,600 miles back and forth, just for whatever the argument, you know, of the day happens to be. The $6 billion cost that they filed on their system, which doesn't include the regasification facilities, because, as he mentioned, that specific lighting that's entered into contract with them, are on 73 unescalated dollars. We don't get involved in 73 unescalated dollars, but on 74 unescalated dollars, then our cost is about $5.2 billion to get it down to the Canadian border. And we haven't tried to escalate their $6 billion figure, but all I'm saying is this, and that is, we had done our best on the 35 to 50 cent difference per MCF and transportation cost, and we hadn't even come up with a figure as high as $6 billion on 73 unescalated costs for their projects, and we're pleased that you have, because it makes ours look even better yet. As far as the senator's questions that he raised, and I'm faced with, every time everybody talks, I have more questions to answer in a sum up that I was going to use the way I wanted to. But anyhow, we'll go ahead and try the sum up. On the question of the native claims that the senator mentioned, and native claims is very near and dear to all of our hearts, and we went through a travail in Alaska a few years ago because of that. And there's reason then for people to conclude, well, in Alaska, then there's because of Alaska's experience and the crude oil line, there's no way for a gas line to be built through Canada until those claims are settled. In the first place, no one ever really answered the question whether or not a Trans-Alaska pipeline could have been built before the native claims were settled. You didn't have to answer it. Most people didn't want to answer it. It didn't even come down to that discussion in the final analysis. But in Canada, the situation is just a little bit different because of the fact that, number one, there are some treaties existing. The natives over there claim that their treaties are invalid because they were signed by someone that isn't there anymore, or they couldn't read the signatures or whatever. And that's really not terribly germane either, except that there have been treaties. And there are treaties in existence over there that are subject to question, too. But in those areas where a treaty isn't possible, or they're not covered by treaty now, the Canadian government hasn't really determined whether their Aboriginal claims are valid in addition to the payments they have now. But even if they concluded that, the Canadian government, our legal experts say, that in the corridor up to Mackenzie, like any other corridor, but as far as the corridor is concerned, if the Canadian Parliament feels that it's in the best interest of all of the peoples of Canada to grant a corridor, extinguish the claims in that corridor, hold the revenues from that rights of way in reserve so as not to prejudice the rights that the native people in that area might have later on, then that restitution could be made. And if the Canadian Parliament decides to take that course, and in fact does it, the decision is not appealable like it is in our country, and it's all over. Now, we are not second-guessing for the Canadian government at all, and I wouldn't presume to do that. But we do have some indications that seem, from our discussions with the Canadian government officials, that they are willing to take that course if it becomes necessary. They are negotiating with the native people now. They want to settle them. We'd like to see them settled. We'd like to see them the best deal for everybody. But if they're not settled, it does not have to be an impediment to our pipeline. We have not included it as an impediment in our pipeline planning because we don't feel that it necessarily is one. In terms of the property taxes and the ability of provinces to tax, I'd like to just talk about that just a little bit and read from a legal opinion that hasn't been, I don't think it's inconsistent with what Senator or John has said, but it may add a little bit of light. This is a legal opinion from independent law firm that we have in Canada that's looked at the problem. The basic starting point is that the Canadian Constitution confers only limited taxation powers upon the provinces. Principally, a province may impose direct taxation within the province in order to raise revenue for provincial purposes. They also have power to license certain provincial activities to raise revenue through the license fees. The courts have construed the provincial taxation powers in such a way as to make it clear that provincial taxes could not unduly interfere with the pipeline corporation, which will be incorporated under federal law and operating an undertaking governed by federal jurisdiction. Specifically, a province could not impose a tax measured by throughput, for this would be an indirect tax. We've also had discussion of that. That would be a tax on the resource itself. It could not interfere with interprovincial trade by imposing taxes on the import of gas into or the export of gas from the province. A province could impose an income tax on the pipeline corporation or a tax on its real and personal property within the province, but these taxes could not be imposed on a basis which was discriminatory against the corporation. A province could require the pipeline company to obtain a license, but the license could not be refused, and the license fee could not be discriminatory. In other words, if they taxed the facilities, they'd have to tax the facility that moved the Canadian gas or that amount of Canadian gas the same way they taxed the other facility, so it wouldn't be discriminatory, just like the states of the United States and the companion facilities that move through the states, just like the state of Alaska. They can tax it, and probably will, and that's great, you know, that's what has to be done. In summary, the taxation powers of a province relative to an interprovincial pipeline are limited. They are similar to those of a state of the United States relative to an interstate pipeline, and not at all of a kind which would interfere with the Arctic Gas Project. The Canadian portion of the Arctic Gas System will be subject to Canadian federal jurisdiction, and therefore no province will have the power to interfere with the volume of gas which enters and leaves or passes through the province. Now, this, of course, is quite different from the situation in which gas is produced in a province. That's John's problem, part of it. In such situations, some Canadian provinces have asserted jurisdiction and limited removals of gas from the provinces. Alberta and the federal government have been fighting for this a long time, but it still hasn't been upheld. Whether such assertion of power will withstand legal challenge under Canadian law, which is denied by many Canadian legal authorities, is irrelevant to the Arctic Gas Project. And this is because the Alaskan and Northwest Territories gas, which will be transported by the Arctic Gas Project, is not, of course, produced in any province, and no province has the authority or has even claimed to have the authority to interfere with the transportation of such gas through the province in a federally authorized pipeline. In terms of environmental considerations, this is where the miles starts going back and forth again. We're talking about two systems. We're talking about the Canadian Arctic Gas System that is about 1,800 miles, a little more than 1,800 miles, from Calgary up to the Richards Island and the Mackenzie Delta. We're talking about another 200 miles from Trevelyan Lake over the border. We're talking about a couple hundred miles from the junction at Calgary to Idaho, another couple hundred over to Montana. Now, we've heard a lot of discussion about the competing facility of one of our companies that's pulled out, Alberta Gas Trunk, and all of a sudden, because one out of 25 is pulled out, that our project doesn't have any economic viability anymore. But they have filed, Alberta Gas Trunk has filed for a system to bring a line down there. The Canadians have to have access to Mackenzie Delta gas. They've got to have access to that Arctic gas sometime within, if it's not before the 80s, it's going to be soon after the 80s. They have an economic problem of getting it economically. But there is going to be a line. We're not really comparing, and besides which, we've done a mile-by-mile, foot-by-foot analysis, answered the environmental questions, all of them that could possibly be raised on that system. We're not really talking about 6,300 miles. We're talking about the difference of 400 miles from Prudhoe Bay to Trevelyan Lake has contrasted with 800 miles of Johns. Now, El Paso's own application indicates an alignment sheet in their own application, their own filing, that they're not going to be in that corridor a whole lot of time at all. And if it's convenient for them to get out of it and go out of it, they do. And there might be some other areas that they haven't even talked about in the application where they're going to have to get out of it too. So it's really not terribly appropriate, and I should point out to say that the natural gas transmission industry's reputation and environmental concerns has been extremely good. I'm not casting any aspersions on any, but all I'm saying is that it's not appropriate to say that there's that much environmental pluses to be gained by the El Paso system. Indeed, I say to you that there are a lot of the aspects that are going to have to come up that relate to the environmental problems of that route that have not even been addressed yet. Number one, on Gravina Point, number two, those areas, and some of them sensitive, where they have to deviate from the existing corridor so far as they have. There's another significant point here that I should mention too, and that is as of now, El Paso hasn't filed an application with the Department of Interior for a right-of-way across federal land. So, I mean, how are the environmental problems going to be discussed in that particular area if they haven't even filed with the Department of Interior yet? They say, well, you know, go ahead and FBC, give us a certificate, then we'll file with you, Interior, and see if you want us, we'll let us build a pipeline across your land. The oil production timing that the Senator has mentioned and Commissioner Herbert has mentioned and everybody else has mentioned, and it's very critical. I have not found a reservoir engineer yet that will say to me that it will impinge on oil production to have to reinject gas back into the Prudhoe Bay Reservoir consistent with the time frame that both of us are planning. The timing of both projects, as far as I can see, based on their application in ours, is about a toss-up. We're both going to start from the same point in time for the U.S. certification, and it's about a toss-up. They say 54 months in their application. We're saying from 4 years, 4.5 years. It's about even. So the timing, whichever one is certified, is going to be there about the same time. And sure, there can be some economics in it. I appreciate it. There's economics for everybody involved, the owners, the people that need the gas, the people of the United States, the state of Alaska, everybody, if that gas isn't produced. But number one, it's not going to be produced until the State Division of Oil and Gas says it's safe to produce it without reinjecting it again. And number one, I don't know of any reservoir engineer that says within the time frame that we're talking about and even beyond that would damage that reservoir at all to reinject the gas back in it again. Senator, you talked about, has anyone addressed the problem of since there have been the Alyeska line is going to bring gas down anyway to power pumping stations on the line. What would be the additional cost to come down to Fairbanks? We have addressed that situation. We're looking for another piece of the information right now, and we'll be getting that soon. And that other piece of the information that we need right now is the impact in terms of cost of fuel for those pumping stations when you come below the four. In other words, what would be their total cost then to pay that? Now, we all know that Alyeska has been extremely busy, and they've got a few other problems on their hands besides assessing certain costs in their pumping stations south of the Brooks Range, and so it's a priority that's not extremely high with them. However, they have given us some preliminary information and will give us some more. What our studies are indicating to us, number one, is if there was the total amount of state royalty gas available to bring to Fairbanks, if it could be used in Fairbanks, you know, it's an economic toss, and the base that we used is what, in our analysis, it would cost the El Paso Company or any Trans-Alaskan project to get the gas from Prudhoe Bay to Fairbanks. If we subsidize that, if the thought was to subsidize it on the U.S. consumers, we're talking about, even without the total royalty gas being available, we're talking about 2 cents to like 18 to 20 cents in MCF. Now, this, believe me, is conjecture because we really haven't faced asking the FPC for the lower 48 to subsidize it, and whether we would or not is rather academic. But the point is, if the royalty gas could be used, yeah, that in Fairbanks, the Fairbanks situation could pay the cost of service to get it here and do it economically, and that could be done. Some people have suggested, well, now, why not instead of bringing the methane to Fairbanks? We don't want the methane. Take that wherever you want it. Just bring us the liquids down. Now, in the first place, nobody's told us that they'd be willing to that kind of trade. And the second place, no one has told us what they do with the liquids if they got them down here. And nobody, believe me, nobody's going to build anything unless they know what they're building it for. As far as the El Paso project is concerned, until they know what they're building it for, that gas is going to go through their system, right where there is a use for it, and that's where they're going to take it. And it's not going to fall off here if there's not a use, and people have to demonstrate a use, so we can't even begin talking about it. I'm going to leave here right away, quick-like, from this podium so someone else can get at it. I'm sorry that the 5 minutes has gone this way. I think as far as the balance of payments is concerned, as part of our application that will be filed shortly after the first of the year, an analysis of the balance of payments prepared by Ezra Solomon in San Francisco. We've seen a draft now. We need to look at the fact that there's a lot of trade between the U.S. and Canada. A lot more trade between the U.S. and Canada than there is just in petroleum products. A lot more. And the effect and the impact of this system on the balance of payments between the United States and Canada, according to what we've seen so far, are going to be minimal. We'll demonstrate that. I mean, anything is significant. We'll demonstrate that before the FPC when the hearing process begins. I think it's rather interesting that an alternative to the to the Alaska systems seems to relate to the fact that El Paso is working diligently on systems to bring gas from Algeria and Russia. Don't seem to be concerned about balance of payments in those systems. I don't quite understand the whole project. But anyway, that's true. So thank you. I'm sure there'll be more questions later.
Thanks, Bob. I'm sure that you'd all like to stand before we turn this over to Don Dennis for the interview from the press. Maybe you'd like to stretch for a minute. And we could bang away at this for about 25 minutes or thereabouts, and then we've got quite a few written questions also.
Thank you, Frank. Appreciate the opportunity to have the press offer some questions here. Maybe we can get some of the questions down into the area where we understand them a little better. I think Bob Hinman ran into him there during the break, and he said he's not worrying about the answers to the question, he's trying to understand the question. I think this has been a lot of the problem with this whole debate. It's generally been handled on one side, then the other side. And I'd like to congratulate first the State Chamber for getting this forum together. I think it's good for everyone. We'll start the press panel with Tad Bartimus of the Associated Press in Anchorage. I'll defer to her because she came the greatest distance today.
Mr. Ward, I'm going to direct my first question to you. In the October 12th issue of the Toronto Globe and Mail, you were quoted as saying that the hope that Alaskan politicians will stick the promises they made to their Midwestern counterparts to support legislation on parts on a McKenzie Valley gas line in exchange for support in expediting the Alyeska oil line. You went on to say, and I quote the quote that's here, and first I will ask you if it's accurate, quote, "I can't really fault Alaskan politicians for their views, but some of them who made commitments are hedging." I ask you, sir, to name the Alaskan politicians who made these commitments to Arctic Gas, and what form these commitments took.
Number one, there have been no commitments that I'm aware. There have been no commitments made to Arctic Gas. Number two, nobody is ever interested about this particular question except the press. Number three, the quote is basically accurate. Basically accurate. I'll talk about that in a minute. I was interviewed in my office by John Picton from the Globe and Mail a few weeks ago. Now, number one, any talks that I've ever made, any presentations that I've ever made, have never related to the fact that Alaska's congressional delegation had commitments to Midwestern congressmen that they should live up to. I've never said it because I don't believe it. Don't say it. Now, what I have said, as a matter of fact, in those commitments is that there isn't a statewide politician in Alaska that's supporting Arctic Gas. I can understand that because for their own political survival, they wouldn't be in a position to support Arctic Gas. If they have commitments with U.S. senators in the Midwest and East, I would expect them to support it. However, there are other influences that come in that may make it impossible for them to stay with those commitments, in which case they'd back off from it if there was impossible to do so. Number one, Mike Gravel is the only senator that's ever told me he didn't have any commitments with anybody, and I could understand that. Number two, I've had a lot of discussions with Senator Stevens and Congressman Young, and they've told me their problems, but they never relate to commitments because I've never asked them if they had any commitments to Midwestern senators or anybody else. That can bear me out. Never asking for it. Or Congressman Young. I understand what their political situation is. If they have commitments, and if they can honor them, I would think that they would.
I think we'll maybe want to get back to this one just a minute, but we'll follow down the line here. And the next question will be from Sue Lewis, who's the news director at KFRB, KTVF.
I'd like to direct my question to Senator Stevens. He said in his address that there's no hurry for Alaskans to make a commitment to either particular application that's been filed so far. At the same time, he said it's urgent that gas be delivered by 1979. I find this to be somewhat inconsistent. I'd like to answer that. And the second part of this question, Senator, you have said you support a Trans-Alaska movement, not particularly the El Paso application. Do you have any indication that other applications from other companies are forthcoming?
On the last question, I have no indication that other applications will be forthcoming. I have taken the position that when Texas Gas was ready to move out of Texas, there were enough Texans who had the fortitude to get together and form pipeline companies like El Paso, and I don't see there's any reason today, with the future that we have and with the capital backing that the state obviously has for Alaskan Ventures, why that shouldn't happen. And really what I've been trying to do, and I have had some meetings with Alaskans, is try to jawbone them into the concept of trying to form an Alaska entity to be involved in this transportation. And perhaps that will happen. The second, as to your first part of your question, why I say it, we're not in a hurry, I think you can see very easily, neither of the companies so far have completed their filing with the FPC. To my knowledge, neither one of them has completely complied with the law as far as the right-of-way is concerned with the Department of Interior. The FPC hearing will take some time. During that time, the state will have a chance to formulate its position and present its views to the FPC and also to the Department of Interior. And under the law that exists, under the right-of-way law, any pipeline in excess of 24 inches must be referred to Congress for its final approval of the action taken by both the FPC and the Department of Interior. So as a practical matter, we've got some time as far as the state of Alaska's position. I'm not talking about having time with regard to the transportation system itself. I believe that we're behind time on that transportation system. As I understand what I've heard here today, as I just said informally here, it's obvious that neither of these companies would be able to have a delivery system ready by 1979, the critical date that I've been informed is involved as far as the production of gas and the necessity to reinject more gas back into the structure at a cost. I don't disagree with Bob Ward about the reservoir characteristics. No one's ever told me it will harm the reservoir to reinject it. It'll just cost money to lift it up, take it out of the oil, and put it back in, and then at a later date to lift it back up again. And that cost will be borne primarily by us because we are a royalty owner. It will reduce the return to us.
The corridor itself varies in width because it goes up like a staircase. Some places it's several miles across. Some cases it's as low as maybe a mile or a mile and a half. The right-of-way, the 54 feet, will be settled into the corridor once the routing is approved. We don't intend to lay it in the same right-of-way. In fact, we want to stay a modest distance from the oil pipeline, if for no other reason than to avoid any thermal effect of a hot oil line on a refrigerated gas pipeline. The engineering is a little different. We have our preliminary trace down, and it's in the library here, if anyone wants to see it. And in some cases, it goes a mile or so away from that. But in some other points, such as Dietrich Pass and Keystone Canyon, because of the defile, the lines will be quite close together. But what we're trying to do is keep a reasonable distance between the two. And it's hard to describe because it varies all the way down, but there is a trace in the public library here of our present trace. Oh, yes, ma'am. That's one reason when we talk about time, we will start with a complete haul road, the gravel pads and everything, not to mention the spreads that Alyeska has here. We intend to follow on Alyeska and use a large number of their resources and people. We have not talked in specific terms with Alyeska. I've met no one there that doesn't think this is the only sensible way to do it, and there are not going to be many other buyers for that plant. So I imagine we can make an agreement. Coast of California. Right. I think that's very close to it. The 12.1 is exact, and 9.6 was the last that I heard quoted by Bob. But is there a change in that, Bob? Is that pretty close?
Oh, there was 9.6. But, yeah.
Well, what is it? Can you tell her?
Is it 25%?
No, it's never been more than 9.2. It'll probably be less than 8. But, you know, these numbers are going to be for the FTC. No way they're going to get there for 12, but the numbers will come out. People... You know,
well, ours is 12.1.
There'll be independent analysis by FPC staff there, and they'll come to a conclusion who's right and make a decision based on it.
It's 12.1 for El Paso.
Well, it's true in a certain context. It was in response to a question from a young fellow who used to be in Juneau with the Associated Press, who's now in Spokane. He talked to me in Spokane, and he said, are you considering Arab money in your financing plan? I said, Arab money is not a component of our financial plan. It never has been, but it's been discussed internally. So the headline was, Arctic Gas Considers Arab Financing for the Project. Now, but the financial plan has a lot of various components. Long-term conventional security, bank interim financing, and there is a component in our financial plan of euro dollars. Rather short-term euro dollars, because there's not a long-term market there. Now, the euro dollars per se, if we are involved in a component of euro dollars, there's Arab money in euro dollars normally, because they trade in rather short-term money in Europe. In terms of long-term Arab financing, we've never made any direct contact to any of the Arab nations to look for financing, recognizing right off the bat that they aren't too involved in long-term financing anyway. We haven't considered it a source for long-term money. We haven't asked them for long-term money. We have been active somewhat in the European market, and the euro dollars, there would be some component of Arab financing.
I'd like to ask a question that maybe General Bennett and Mr. Ward could both address themselves to. Throughout the entire period that we've been dealing with the gas line, both the people from the gas companies and the press and the public have realized and have said that there's a lot of public relations efforts going into it. Gas companies have had top officials up here, and they've made these comments. Then we get around to the actual use of the royalty gas in Alaska. We're told repeatedly, yes, it's possible, but you show us where the need is. It would seem to me that the public relations effort, certainly within the gas companies involved, there are a lot of people that rub shoulders with uses of gas all the time. I would think that a more valuable public relations effort on selling the backing of Alaska, and it's been mentioned many times today where the politicians stand or how the public feels, that instead of taking the approach of you tell us what you can do with it, and then we'll do something, that you should take the other tack, turn it around, and help Fairbanks or Alaska with what the possible uses are, who the contacts are, and this kind of thing. Do you have any comments on that?
Yes, I do. I really think that private companies ought to be very, very careful not to get into business that is very sensitive, very difficult, and is in the hands of the state of Alaska. I'm glad that Chuck Herbert's here today. I know that Chuck has talked to several petrochemical companies in specific terms. I know he can't share that with us because it is explosive information, just like we know there are several proposals for our royalty oil in the States. Now, my company is not bidding on any feedstocks or proposing to put in any petrochemical plants here, and I think just from the standpoint of being truthful, it's easy to mislead Alaskans when we make specific proposals when we are not getting ready to enter this ourselves. That's the reason that I'm very hesitant to say anything about this. Now, as for assistance, I think that I can say honestly, and I think Bill Wood will back me up here, I think that Chuck will back me up, that where we've been able to furnish information and talk with people about the possibilities, but we've done everything we can as a private company on invitation to cooperate. Matter of fact, next week I'm going to be in Fairbanks, and a fellow I met in Washington who happens to represent a petrochemical company is going to be up here and have dinner with about a dozen people in here. He has nothing to do with our company, but that type of assistance on bringing interested people up here when we meet them, we're perfectly willing to do. But I want to be very clear that we are not in anything right now except the gas transmission business, and we have to be very careful not to create that impression and mislead people. Do you want to comment on that?
Did you want me to? Were you asking me to comment on that? Our companies originally started out to solve all the problems to avoid all the problems that seemingly started with Alyeska, and the problems that were involved in Alyeska seemed to relate primarily to environmental and engineering aspects, recognizing that we were going through some country that hadn't been gone through before, and we had a different system. There were some new concepts, even though it was conventional, that we were talking about refrigerated lines, fully buried, built off snow roads across the tundra. We had to find out the caribou migration patterns. That was the area that we focused in. In the meanwhile, back at the ranch, while we were doing all that work and spending $40, $50 million, then all of a sudden we had a competitor, so the problem was changed a little bit. And a very substantial competitor. So at that particular point in time, we felt that a couple things were important: to continue the efforts that we had been conducting in engineering and environmental aspects, get our applications ready to file, but also to show to the people of Alaska that we were establishing a company in Alaska that was going to build and own and operate the pipeline, going to be involved in the future of Alaska. We hired Alaskans in that particular operation, and that's the thrust that we're doing, establishing our presence and providing our image in Alaska. Now, but there are a couple of slight differences between our approach and the approach that El Paso's taken in public relations. Now, to talk about the fact that, haven't asked anybody for anything or hadn't gotten involved in anything, we haven't asked one Alaskan
or one group for a single resolution of support for Arctic gas. We haven't twisted a single arm. We haven't told the legislature that if they do something, or if they didn't do it, we wouldn't spend $30 million. So they did it, and we didn't spend it anyway. We have not engaged in that kind of activity at all. What we are saying is that the companies that own Arctic Gas have been involved in Alaska's progress for a long time, and they're going to continue to be involved. They want Arctic Gas to be involved. They want us to help. Now, people can't tell us, in the first place, can't say to us and say, your system will not make any royalty gas available in Alaska, and expect us to say, okay, our system can't make any royalty gas available in Alaska. People tell us our system can't make any royalty gas available in Alaska, so we tell them how it can. The trade out of royalty was our idea in the first place. The study that we've done of fuels in the Fairbanks area is the only time that a company had done it to that degree. We don't consider that to be necessarily misleading or in an area that we shouldn't be in. We just think that's a practical way that a company does business in Alaska ought to operate.
I really can't answer that, but it'll have to treble the production of the largest gas field in North America to use the capacity we know is already going to be there. So there's quite a bit of space in there to be filled up. And when I said $10 billion, that is the latest report. That's this year's report. It's interesting to me that last year's report by the transmission companies put it at $7 billion. This excess capacity has jumped $4 billion in the estimates in the last year. So our gas supplies are dwindling very rapidly. But no one would be happier than I am if Mexico can fill some of that $10 billion feed.
So there's room for that?
Oh, there's certainly. I would hope that eventually some Mexican gas would go in those pipelines because we're so terribly short of gas in the lower 48. But there's so much of it there that I think, meanwhile, it's pretty good to use a third of it if we can. That's all I'm saying.
We've considered a variety of options from 12-inch to 24-inch pipeline from Prudhoe Bay down to the Fairbanks area, serving compressor or pumping stations of Alaska along the route. We've considered then what would be the required throughput in that gas to make the economics balance between what a Trans-Alaska pipeline could make that resource available in the Fairbanks area. If the full amount of royalty gas and what we consider to be the royalty gas of normal production in Prudhoe Bay, and I should clarify a point here too, our system is predicated on 2.25 billion cubic feet a day from Prudhoe Bay and 2.25 billion cubic feet a day from the Mackenzie Delta, building up in a 5-year period from Mackenzie, a 3-year period from Prudhoe Bay. If there's more gas available in Prudhoe Bay, our line that we're going to take from Prudhoe Bay to the Trevelyan Lake Junction is capable, fully powered, of 4.5 billion cubic feet a day, but in the initial instance, our financing plan, our whole application is predicated on 4.5 billion cubic feet a day. Our system would accommodate additional capacities, indeed is designed to do that. So I wouldn't want it to imply that one system is going to take the gas that's available on the north slope and the other one isn't. The gas that's available adjacent to our system will take it to the market. In terms of the Fairbanks system, again, the royalty volumes that we were talking about was 218 million cubic feet a day, and as it's been talked about here today, it could be anywhere from 150 to 400, whatever it is. But we predicated our system on what we assumed the royalty would be, 218 million cubic feet a day. If there was a market for it in Fairbanks now, it'd be economical to build a pipeline from Prudhoe Bay here. I should point out, now Don, you cut me off if you want to, but there are a lot of companies that are involved in deep drilling, spending money like they've never spent it before, and deep drilling in the Anadarko Basin. El Paso may be involved in that, I don't know. I know they're active in the Gulf. And the people that are drilling offshore in the Gulf, also doing deep drilling in the Anadarko Basin, kind of think it might be a little handy to have some of that capacity he's talking about. Also, that capacity is average day volumes and not peak day volumes. So I'd suggest that that picture, too, is not as clear as it may look.
Okay.
able to guess. I know that if we had enough, you'd probably let everybody who applied have it. I know that quite a few companies did apply, and I believe there was some information on that a long time ago. Could you bring some to date on some of that?
Oh, well, Helen, it's pretty hard to say other than some very substantial companies as well as some hopeful people have shown interest. And generally the state has discouraged specific recommendations because we're not wanting a company to tip its hand too much about what they want to do. We've told them generally that when the commission that was established by the legislature is operating, that there will be guidelines set down, and this would cover both oil and gas. And we look into it as the two for petrochemical industry are not quite separable. That is, you have products from an oil refinery that can be used along with the natural gas to provide a variety of products in the petrochemical industry. All I can say, and I can assure you, that there is a great deal of interest in both. That is, the establishment of at least one large refinery. Proposals have been going from the one in Fairbanks, which I'm sure you're all familiar, quite a few of them in the 150,000 barrel a day, and at least one talking about 250,000 barrels a day. Well, we look upon the very strong possibility that you might establish something like you do in Texas, where both oil and gas have been used to establish in one area a substantial petrochemical industry. And of course we're quite interested with all the shocking news about a world food shortage that also reflects on the well-known fertilizer shortage and the sudden demands upon Cook Inlet to supply the state of Washington in spite of the Jones Act. I think everyone knows about that. So we do hope that some of the resources of this state will be used first of all for Alaska and for the most economical use of the product itself.
I'd like to go back. Senator Stevens mentioned in his talk if we don't have the use for all the royalty gas at the time of the line, that there was a possibility of taking some of it in money and then picking up later. However, you said there's a possibility that any gas committed to an interstate pipeline could not later be kept in Alaska. I was wondering, how Alaska, what would a parallel be between Alaska and, say, Texas or Louisiana under this? Did those states, when they began in this area, did they have total use? And the other part of the question is, it occurs to me that during the energy shortage last year, one of the things blamed of the troubles in the Northeast was that the amount of gas coming out of Texas and Louisiana was being kept there for use in that area. And how do these states have that control when we have the possibility of not having any control over this gas?
Don, the answer to that lies in the intrastate systems that exist in those states as opposed to the interstate systems. Once gas enters an interstate pipeline, it's under long-term contracts approved by the FPC, and the problem that I've raised is once these contracts are entered into, if they involve a commitment in El Paso's instance of if they're going to build a LNG plant to convert 3+ billion cubic feet per day to LNG, if we take our 1/8, it obviously is going to affect their economics. It's also going to cut off the people that are involved in the long-term contracts on the West Coast or through their system that's up here in the board. If the Arctic takes it out through a gas pipeline system that blends in with the system that exists in the Midwest, it too will be committed to long-term contracts. And it's my understanding that once that is committed, the royalty owners would not be able to withdraw their gas. Now, Chuck's people, the state's attorneys are working very hard on trying to find a way not to commit that gas. And I hope we're able to do it. But the reason that we're different from Texas and Louisiana and Oklahoma and what happened during the crisis was the states that faced the curtailment thought that the amount of gas that was being kept in the intrastate systems ought to be changed, and that has led to a great press in Congress to do away with the intrastate exemption from FPC control, because that gas that's in the intrastate system is not subject to FPC control and could not be taken from the gas-producing states in the South 48, particularly in the Southwest up into the Middle West and New England, where the shortage was the greatest. So the real problem is the difference here. We don't have an intrastate system. No one yet has proposed an intrastate system. As I said, if it's possible to ever jawbone some of the people in the state that have the capability to get together to produce such a system, I think it is feasible. As Bob has said, it is, if we had the demand, the economic feasibility is there for the transportation system to utilize our gas in Alaska. I even made the statement once that if I could be assured that we could have the system intrastate to take care of the 1/8, I think that it makes little difference to us where the other 7/8 goes. Because in terms of the long-range history of the state, the interest of the state, in my opinion, is not in the investment in the pipeline. It's in the long-term investment to utilize the gas here that will produce the jobs and produce the kind of economy that would be quite beneficial to the state. The pipeline construction period will be over very quickly, and after that happens, all we will get from either system will be tax returns and the payment in cash for our royalty, as opposed to the great benefit of a distribution system on an intrastate basis within the state. Now, I really think that's the goal we ought to try and press for. So far, we haven't had any takers.
Senator Stevens, you indicated that you wanted to comment. I'll ask this congressional delegation.
Yes, and I hope, Don, you'll allow me a little time to comment on this, because I think it's something that Bob has mentioned legitimately. I can say I made no commitments to any senator that I would support any system at the time of the pipeline, oil pipeline was approved. However, at that time, we faced a very tough problem, and the problem came primarily from the Middle West. The people who sought to block our pipeline and require the construction of an oil pipeline through Canada were very numerous. You'll recall that the vote was tied 49-49, and the Vice President broke that tie, and we got our pipeline, our oil pipeline, on one vote. That vote broke down politically of 50 votes. One was the Vice President. There were 29 Republicans, and there were 21 Democrats. We had 43 Republicans at the time, and the breakdown was 57 Democrats. There were, in that group of the 28 senators plus the Vice President, there were 17, including the Vice President, that were from areas that were served by the companies that form